Now, if you would please help me welcome our speaker tonight, Bill from Bath, PA. His home group is the Tuesday morning Wind Gap Step Study Group. Please welcome Bill.
Hi, everybody. My name is Bill, and Bill's an alcoholic. I wanted to there's a couple of quotes from Bill W. that helped me get grounded when I'm telling my story, and I'll explain why in a minute. This is from Bill's. It's really a letter, but it was an article in the Grapevine. This is AA approved material from the Grapevine, and it's entitled "The Next Frontier: Emotional Sobriety." I think that many oldsters who have put our AA booze cure to severe but successful tests still find they often lack emotional sobriety. Perhaps they will be the spearhead for the next major development in AA, the development of much more real maturity and balance, which is to say humility, in our relations with ourselves, with our fellows, and with God. How shall our unconscious, from which so many of our fears, compulsions, and phony aspirations still stream, be brought into line with what we actually believe, know, and want? How to convince our dumb, raging, and hidden Mr. Hyde becomes our main task. I've recently come to believe that this can be achieved. Believe so because I begin to see many benighted ones, folks like you and me, commencing to get results. Now, that was written, Bill's writing about the disturbance that he has, and he's writing that after he's sober 24 years. And then this one more. This is a quote from a letter that Bill wrote to Ed Dowling. It may be that someday we shall devise some common denominator of psychiatry. Of course, throwing away their much abused terminology. Common denominators which neurotics could use on each other. The idea would be to extend the moral inventory of AA to a deeper level, making it an inventory of psychic damages, reliving in conversation episodes, etc. I suppose someday a Neurotics Anonymous will be formed and will actually do all this. He later suggests the inventory be about actual episodes, inferiority, shame, guilt, anger, so they could be relieved in the mind and their power reduced. The true non-neurotic self could then emerge out of hiding. I read that because I believe that my drinking was something I engaged in to cope with a lot of beliefs that I formed, many about myself. And they were beliefs that resulted in many failures. I think all my relationships were failures. So I'm going to talk about some of the things I experienced in my younger life. When I did my first inventory, I had 30 pages of resentments in terms of my mother, who I profess to have a great hatred for. And in AA, I learned that I really don't hate any person. I hate certain character defects. And so I had a hatred for certain character defects of my mother, all of which I have. many to a greater extent than my mother. And I don't want to suggest, I grew up in a situation where there was a fair amount of physical violence. I don't want to suggest that that physical violence is necessary to experience these false beliefs. Hurts, traumas, injuries occur in many ways on an emotional and spiritual level, which I believe are far more damaging than the physical. But my mother was drunk a lot. She was a schizophrenic. She was diagnosed as bipolar, mentally ill, very violent, very condemning, harshly critical, perpetrator of sexual abuse. And I grew up, my father was also very violent. My father was what I refer to as a rageaholic. It was not possible for me to know when in a fraction of a second he would come out of flying out of a chair and be violent. He was so violent, and I had forgotten this episode. You know, I believe that I repressed a lot of the things that I experienced as a defense. But my sister reminded me of this, and I recollected it immediately. And she said to me, "Do you remember the time Daddy was beating you?" And Mommy stuck her head around the kitchen wall and said, "Be careful, you're going to kill him, and then we'll really have problems." That was the nature of the physical violence. But the emotional violence was unremitting. I don't know how to say it. It was very damaging. And as children, you know, this is my belief, we absorb this stuff. It's not a question of choice. There's not, you know, like today I have these 12 beautiful steps, you know, and the grace of God, which says to me, that's a bad idea, or that's, you know, that's not the right thing. And I believe higher power, one of the ways higher power communicates with me today is through my emotions. In other words, I'll say something mouthy, and I'll feel this like a shock almost. And I'll know, you know, one of my favorite slogans is just shut up. So I just shut up when that happens. But as children, or as a child, I did not have those tools. So I began to get a lot of beliefs about myself that, you know, centered around inferiority, inadequacy, and so on. They weren't true, but I believed them. I took them in. And I lived my life according to those. I went to a parochial school. I just want to mention that, you know, I don't think I would be alive today except for the grace of God. I've been told many times in meditation that most people who experience what I experienced are either dead or institutionalized. And I've been institutionalized a lot. But through the grace of God and the fellowship of AA and other 12-step fellowships, you know, I have a happy, joyful life today. So this all ends well. I was around drinking. My mother's family, which is where we did most of our socializing, were drinkers. My father's family, I didn't know well. They came from Cleveland, Ohio, as my father did, and were much different. His two brothers were ministers, and his father was a member of the Seventh-day Adventist, but he was a just an incredibly joyful, spiritually oriented man. But I didn't have much exposure to them, and I thought of him as a Jesus freak. In other words, I was very critical of him without knowing him, which was the way I lived a large part of my life. You know, character assassination was my conversation. If I couldn't assassinate you, we didn't associate. You know, and a friend was someone who welcomed being assassinated. You know, it's just, I have these crazy, what appear to be crazy beliefs today. I also developed a lot of habits, which, I'm going to use the term survival traits. There were ways for me to survive. You know, like I had a fear of authority. My parents were authority figures. They were trouble. I went to a parochial school. The nuns were trouble. I was a confused kid in the sense that I think I was a sick kid. I think I was sick from an early age. I had immense confusion about what was expected of me. And I think that that's centered around the fact that there was no consistency other than beating in the home. And one day it would be for one thing, and the next day it would be for something not associated with that at all. And there would be these rules would be announced after the transgression had occurred. So, you know, I would be, as I was beaten, I would be informed I'd violated a certain rule. And there was no consistency to this. It was it's hard to get a grasp. So I stayed away from adults. And so, you know, I went through parochial school and high school. I was not a drinker. I wasn't drawn to it in the least. But when I went to college, you know, I do remember abandoning a relationship with God. And it was, my beliefs were very superficial. I don't think that has anything, you know, the people that tried to train me religiously were sincere in their efforts. But other kids were saying they got bikes and things like that from praying. And when I prayed, I didn't get anything. So I figured God was like my parents. And I didn't want anything to do with them. I became very violent in high school. And I had this idea that no one was going to treat me like my parents treated me. And I took that to an extreme also, that if you disagreed with me, you were out to get me. And one of my beliefs were that if you were out to get me, which I believed, you hadn't done anything, I would get you first. So that was the foundation of my, you know, a lot of my relationships. When I went to college, I went to a fraternity rush party, and I got drunk. I was drinking beer, and I started to feel woozy, and somebody said, go outside, you know, and get some fresh air. And I went out with a friend of mine from high school. We went to the same undergraduate school. And I said to him, you know, isn't this great? And I'm like, I'm partially sick, you know. And I realized many years later that I was relieved of the fears I didn't know I had for a period of time by drinking that alcohol. And a life shift occurred for me that evening. I went from a person who didn't drink to a person who got drunk at every opportunity, certainly every Friday and Saturday if I wasn't too sick from Friday. So I made that shift and I never noticed it. My life changed right there. I was a student in high school who didn't study. I didn't take home books and so forth. And in college, I don't really know if I learned how to study, but I have one of those memories where I don't know if I have it anymore. But I can remember taking an exam and saying, I know I read that, and flipping to the page in my mind and reading the answer to myself and writing it down. So I was good at taking tests. You know, I could feedback. I think I had a very shallow understanding of what I was doing. In other words, my education was not something that I took advantage of. And I've had a lot. I got a college degree and a master's degree and then some work beyond that. So this drinking, then, I used to say things like, let's have a drink. I never meant let's have a drink. I always meant let's get drunk, because if it was a matter of having one drink, I didn't drink. And at a point, I stopped drinking. I was still at that point where I could never stay stopped. But I would stop drinking for years at a time. Always why? Because I got myself in a jam. And I somehow knew alcohol was involved, but I would start drinking again, and there would be no thought of the thing that I stopped drinking for. One time, my wife and I were out to dinner with my psychiatrist and her husband, and my psychiatrist said to me, "Why don't you have a drink?" I hadn't been drinking, and I said to myself, "Yeah, why don't I have a drink?" And I started drinking again. With the same results. I drank, you know, I did experience progression in alcoholism. I remember one night, I got my graduate degree at night, coming home from a class, you know, and I was feeling a lot of stress. I had a full-time job in New York, and the school was down in Lawrenceville, New Jersey, and I used to, you know, drive down there and then for 3 hours of class and then drive home. Drinking a bottle of this Hublin Manhattan mix just to go to sleep. And a lot of problems with sleeping. The problems with violence, I believe that today I would be arrested for the kind of violence that I always was. Started with people who were larger than me, because I had this fear I was going to be blamed for, and it was usually with people who were, you know, agitators. They would agitate me, and I had so much anger in me that that other poor person was, you know, it was like fighting 50 people, and something would trip. And once that trip went and the adrenaline started to flow, I didn't feel, you know, I never felt getting hit. I never worried about getting hit. I just was insane. You know, I have to say that I met my wife when I was my wife-to-be, when I was a freshman in college. And my wife is not a. I've probably seen her drunk three times in our life. I don't know how we. That was a God thing, I think. You know, another God thing. But my wife was in New Brunswick, and I was living in Lawrenceville, New Jersey, and I had no idea what faithfulness was. You know, I was going out with other girls, and even though I was pinned and even engaged, I mean, that's how I behaved. You know, and if someone did that to me, I would have been appalled. But I didn't think anything of the fact that I was doing it to other people. I had no sense of self other than this negative, inferior, inadequate person. And my performance in college was, you know, pretty good. I was nominated into Who's Who in American colleges and universities. I was on the dean's list most of the time. I became the president of my fraternity. But as I went on in college, I became more fearful and depressed. I've been institutionalized many times, had a couple of sets of shock treatments. I had labels like schizophrenic, schizoid affective disorder, which is schizophrenia and bipolar combined, multiple personality disorder, borderline personality disorder. Those are the people I'm attracted to, by the way. My wife first pointed that out to me. And continued to drink, never suspecting that I had a problem with alcohol. Well, that's probably a lie. Now, I would go out to, there's a place called Carrier Clinic in New Jersey, where I've spent quite a bit of time. And I remember a doctor asking me, one of these psychiatrists asking me, "Do you drink?" And I assured him I was a social drinker. I had no idea what that was, but I was hiding something, right? I was not telling him how much I drank. And then he'd start asking me questions, and he'd say things to me like, "Do you get strange messages over the radio?" And I'd say no, thinking, there's nothing strange about those messages. So, on it went. I was born at a time. The Vietnam War was raging when I graduated from college, and I got a draft notice from the Army, and I joined the Marine Corps in an officer program, and I realized very quickly the Marine Corps was not the best spot for someone who didn't take orders. I envisioned myself, in this uniform with all these medals on, and I didn't realize there was basic training. So, and to give you an example of how my life went, I had another life-changing experiences too, really. I was in, officers' candidate class, and it was sleeting. I was in there in January, February, early March, down on the Potomac, and the wind was whistling, and there was a sleet storm out, and we're going on a 10-mile forced march. Oh, God. And then I heard there was a test. And what I wanted to know about the test was, how long is it? In other words, can I miss the forced march? Yeah. So I took the test, and that's how I ended up in flight school. And they have, on the test, they show you these pictures of how things would look from an aircraft when you're in various, positions. I had no idea. I'd never been in an airplane. So I went to flight school as a bombardier navigator. I didn't have the eyesight to be a pilot. And when I was there, I believe that I was deeply depressed when I was going through this officer's candidate class. And, getting drunk, there wasn't that much opportunity to get drunk, but doing that when there was opportunity. And I started to get really depressed. I mean, the physical activity I found helped my depression. In other words, I functioned better. And there was a really high level of physical activity in officers' candidate class. Even though I was deeply depressed, I did well. I think I was like number 22 out of a little over 500. About 40% of us became officers. So I did well, even though I was sick, through the grace of God. And I went down to flight school, but in flight school, we were on a naval base down in Pensacola, and the physical regimen dropped off, so the depression took off. And I didn't know what to make of it. I didn't know it was depression. And I said, I concluded that it was some problem with the flight training and that I was going to go back to ground school Quantico. And so I met another guy, and I talked to him, and we agreed, you know, he was going to opt out as well. And we went to this naval officer, and he's talking to both of us, and he said, you know, have you thought about this? He said, have you ever been in a Phantom? You know, I want to get in that Phantom. And I said, no. And he said, would you like to take a flight? And I wanted to go. But I said to myself, I can't do that because I committed to this guy who I hardly knew that I was going to go back to Quantico with him. Now, that's the level of confusion that I experienced in those times. And I did go back to Quantico, and I couldn't do that either, and I went over to the infirmary, and there was a doctor there, and he said, you got to talk to a psychiatrist. And he sent me up to Bethesda Naval Hospital, and the guy said, you don't belong in the Marine Corps, you know. I got an honorable discharge. It was a medical discharge for being emotionally unstable. And that was probably an understatement. but I didn't know it at the time. You know, went home, got a job, going to doctors, telling them, taking phenobarbital, and I end up, you know, depressed again. The drinking continued. And, you know, I'd gotten married. I'd gotten married along the way. And I got married because that's what you did after you graduated from college. You got married. That's what I did. And you know, it was a very liberal time, but I got married because I wanted sex all the time. and my poor wife, I never had the thought, what am I bringing to this marriage? It was all about, what am I going to get out of this? Which was, you know, the epitome of the root of our troubles, that self-centeredness. And that's all I knew. That's all I knew, thinking about self. I don't know how my wife stood it. I mean, it's a testament to her level of sanity and faith in God. My wife also got into a 12-step program, which was, you know, just immensely valuable for us. So, how did I get into AA? I was living alone. I left my wife. So living alone in this little cottage we had in Bucks County, Pennsylvania. It's out in the boonies. A lovely place. Not drinking, but crazy. And I started to go to these things called ACOA meetings. And I met a guy there. He had been a priest, and he came out of the priesthood, and he was giving free talks. And I went up to him, and I started telling him I needed to go someplace because I was feeling this depth of this depression, and I did not believe I would survive another set of shock treatments. You know, the second round I had, I never really fully recovered from. It affected me deeply. And I went down. I ended up, you know, there were several places I could have gone, one of which was a really cushy place out in Phoenix. And with horseback riding and tennis, and I knew if I went there, you know, I was dead. So I heard about, there was a program through this therapist. There was a program down in Suncoast Hospital in Indian Rocks, Florida. And it was run by a woman who had tutored under Claudia Black. And they were doing an exercise called family sculpting. And so I went down there for that, and we did this family sculpting every day. But we used to go to meetings, and early in that time at this rehab, they treated substance abusers, codependents, people like me who was considered myself an adult child of an alcoholic. And one day there wasn't an ACOA meeting. There was an AA meeting. And I had one drink in the previous 3 years. I was still nuts and growing more so, but I wasn't drinking. So it never occurred to me I might be an alcoholic. But one day there was not an ACOA meeting, and I went to an AA meeting as a substitute. And it was a meeting with about 200 people. And I walked in, and just the sound, you know, if you listen to the laughter pre-meeting, you know, and you compare it to what you hear coming out of a bar room, you know, the bar room sounds barbaric. And I was intrigued and entranced. And I've gone there, I got this hospital belt, a hospital bracelet on, and I say to myself, maybe I could come here, you know, I might be able to help these people. But it started me thinking, and I started thinking, why don't I drink? You know, why am I not drinking? And I went to this therapist, and she had me do this exercise of kinds, amounts, consequences, things like that. So I got in front of the group, and, you know, I'm laying out things like, you know, my wife put a loaded revolver in my gut one night when we were both drunk. I mean, I guess the question was, did you ever experience any violence or any domestic violence? And I never, other than a little gunplay, there wasn't anything. But I started recollecting these things. And the therapist, when I got finished with the group, was happy to inform me that, you know, I was entitled to full membership. And she said to me, did you ever do drugs? And I said, no, you know, I'm not a drug addict. I was too afraid to do drugs. I had that sense that if I ever did that, I never would have come back. So she said, well, did you ever go to the doctor? Of course I went to the doctor, you know, she said, did you ever get a prescription? I said, of course I had a prescription. You know, it used to be those big labels, don't take this with alcohol. And I used to think, there must be some weak links that, you know. I'm sitting there. So she says to me, well, how did you take your prescriptions? I said, I took them how I felt like it. What do you think? She says, you're a drug addict too. And I totally broke down at that point. So I began to go to AA meetings, and they recommended to me very quickly. They said, we think you should go to a halfway house. And I didn't know anything about that, except what I saw on television, you know, drug dens and so on. So I sat there for like 2 hours thinking about it. And through the grace of God, you know, God was talking to me, and what I heard was, you have no idea how to be any better when you go home than you were when you came in. And I asked to be over, and I went over to this place in Tampa, Turning Point of Tampa. And it was a marvelous place. It was a little village of condominiums that was surrounded by a river, so it was private. And I went there, and I stayed there for a year and a half. I spent 6 months as a pure client. I spent another 6 months as a house manager, which for me was more recovery work. And during that time, I was going to four AA meetings a day. Four AA meetings a day. And I was convinced, I was so hopeless, I was convinced AA would not work for me. And I see these people come in, and, you know, of course I knew who was going to get sober, and I said, I don't know what she's coming here for, you know, she has no chance, and this person. And so I'd see these people for 4 hours a day, and they started getting better. And I remember saying to myself, something's going on here. Maybe if I keep coming, it'll happen for me. And I got a sponsor who was... started taking me through the steps right away. And so he starts reading the big book to me, right? And so I'm thinking to myself, who the hell is this guy reading to me? You know, I got two college degrees. And it was exactly what I needed. That was my arrogance. And I didn't realize that, you know, I had passed from hopelessness to hope when I said, maybe it can happen to me. And this fellow was quite a bit younger than me, and he was marvelous. You know, he took me through the steps the first time. And we went word for word out of the book, you know, and that's what I do with people today, word for word out of the book. And I believe that it's the book that contains the program, not me. And so I want people to be exposed to the book. But then I give my take on, you know, how whatever we're reading played out in my life and what I tried to do and what I found was successful for me and what wasn't. Nothing helped my depression like the 12 steps. I think today I'm virtually free of depression. These other labels, schizophrenia, bipolar, you know, borderline personality, multiple personality, you know, that's not something that I have to deal with anymore. I learned by practicing these principles how to have a relationship with, first of all, with my wife, and then with my children, one of whom, you know, I hadn't talked to for years. I had a relationship with my parents that I was estranged from for, I don't know, 10, 15 years. Don't remember exactly. I was on a disability, and I tried to go back to work a number of times, and I couldn't work. I had to accept that, you know, and that was challenging for someone. I was my job, you know. I had reached the level of a senior vice president, and so I was in corporate boardrooms and running companies, and I went from that to making wallets at Carrier Clinic. That certainly helped my humility. I learned how to, you know, I was telling you about the negative things about myself. I learned how to be loving. And that's what Bill Wilson said was the key to his success in overcoming these problems that he had realized he had at 24 years. Bill began to try to love everybody. And I try to do that. I try to treat everyone with respect. I find that it's the people that I don't agree with are my best educators. I've had to take attitudes like, I might be wrong about this, instead of I know I'm right. And that's a statement of open-mindedness for me. I might be wrong about this. It made a listener out of me. I've tried to be understanding. Let me give you some examples that have come up fairly recently for me. There were, in high school, I remember, I'm going to concentrate on girls in particular. Incidentally, I think women are generally smarter than men, so I want to get that out of the way. these girls were called airheads, space outs. You know, they're spaced out. And I've come to realize that in large measure, what I was seeing was dissociation. People who had been traumatized and couldn't focus. I have ADD, and I couldn't focus. And I realized that one of the reasons I couldn't focus is that I always had to stay alert for the next attack. I didn't know when or where. And it wasn't consistent, so there was no way, there were no predictors. And I believe these people, these women in particular, I'm sure men have it too. In another case, there were women, girls, who were loose sexually, and we had a word for that. And I've come to realize that people like me who were abused and incested and so forth, which happens to a large proportion of the female population, that the need to be liked or loved or whatever word we use is so great that to do something for somebody that appreciates you, if only for a few minutes, is such a contrast to what you came from that it sparks that behavior. I just want to be liked. I just want to be told I'm okay. I can identify with that. So my, you know, my view of the world is a lot different. That sick man prayer allowed me to change my relationship with my parents. My father was hospitalized. I think he was in his early 80s. And he was hospitalized because my mother was hospitalized. And my mother was hospitalized because she fell down the stairs and she was passed out in the basement for 3 or 4 days, as far as we can tell. And you know, I tried to take care of my father, but he was incontinent, and it was really a difficult thing. They didn't have air conditioning in their house. It was 95 degrees. So there was a nursing home up the street. So I put dad in there, and I figured it was going to be for a week, and that my mother would recover. My mother never recovered. You know, she never came back. I mean, she also had physical injury from this fall. You know how our feet are like that? Well, her feet were like this, and she couldn't stand anymore. And she couldn't even stand to get in a wheelchair. They used to use this crane. She got very heavy, so she had one of these extra big wheelchairs. So they were both in the nursing home. And I couldn't take my mother out. There was no way to get her in the car. But I became their caretaker. My sister tricked them into signing power of attorney for me because she couldn't deal with it. She actually left New Jersey and went to Florida. And I asked God to give me whatever he could to allow me to treat them the way I was treated, as the way I wanted to be treated as a kid. And I got that. I got that from God. And I used to go down there every week, and I would take my father out, you know, and my father was having trouble. And one of the doctors said to me, you know, I think he's got, he might have a condition called hydrocephaly, water on the brain. And my mother was against any kind of surgery or operation. So I made the decision. I thought about it. I said, what would I want to have somebody do for me? Because the alternative was that he was going to continue to deteriorate. And so, you know, I made arrangements. I took him over to the hospital. He went into the operating room. I went back and told my mother what I did. And then I went back. And when I went to see my father in the recovery room, he was a totally different man. He had not been able to hold a conversation. He could not initiate. And here he was talking, you know, like he didn't have any issues. And I remember shortly after that going to to the hospital, and I remember seeing my father cry for the first time. And my mother was telling him, your son did this for you, you know. And it was, you all did that for him, you know. That's where I got this. And you know, it's interesting. I began saying to my father, I love you, Dad. And he started saying, you know, and then me too. And I think when he was 86 years old, he told me he loved me. And my dad actually changed from that violent, you know, that violent person. My mother, I don't think changed. I was talking to my mother one day, and I said, you know, Mom, I like to take you out when Dad and I go out every week, but I said, there's no way to get you in the car. When my youngest son was married, you know, we hired a van. a wheelchair kind of van, and you could wheel the wheelchairs in, strap them down, and that's how they went. But there's no way to get my mother in the car. And I said, Mom, there's no way I can get you in the car. And my mother said to me, you could if you wanted to. So, you know, the poor woman was still stuck with all of that. I had a terrible relationship with my mother-in-law, and I went to her to make amends, and she told me, get off the porch. We tried to straighten you out, and, you know, I said, okay. I said, I understand. Have a blessed evening. And I left, and I knew that I would have to make amends if that opportunity ever came, and it did. And where I live, there's two houses on my property, and my mother-in-law got to live there in that second house, which is an old barn. It's beautiful. Got to live there for 7 years. And I was responsible for giving her medication and making sure she got enough to eat every day. She was suffering from dementia, and finally her hip gave out. But that was another part of my amends process. I went to see my oldest son, who hadn't talked to me for a couple of years. And he had my grandson there. And my grandson was 2 years old, and I'd never seen him. And my son's got a porch that's got like 4 or 5 steps, and he's standing at the top of the porch, and I'm standing at the bottom making my amends. I just went there because my sense was if I called him up, I'd never get a chance to see him. So I went. And, you know, and he said, you don't know him, do you? And I said, no, I don't, you know. And I was crying. I was crying while I was making my amends. And and I realized after I left that there was more that I had to do. There's some things I'd forgotten in the heat of the moment, the emotion that I was experiencing. And I called him up and I said, I got to see you again, you know. And he said, okay. And then he called me up and he said, look, I don't want to see you, and I don't want you to ever call me again. And I said, okay. I said, that's very hard to hear, but I'm going to respect your request. And within 6 months, that was all gone, you know. And we had a better relationship. Grace of God, I didn't. The results were not up to me. I did my part, you know, and then I also, the same thing happened with my mother-in-law. It took about 6 months, and I was able to have relationships with them, my oldest son was the most effective. I think I was the oldest one in my family, and I think I was. I'm going to say this. I think I was more affected than my sister. But my sister was the person I was told I should be more like. She was younger than me. And you know, my sister did not survive her childhood. She committed suicide at 50 years of age. A fourth attempt. Beautiful person. But she had all this stuff in her. She also got into some 12-step programs. But she didn't get to deal with all the stuff. You know, she had to flee from mom and dad. I have a wonderful life today, and my wife and I always wanted to live on a farm. We live on a farm. We've got 4 horses. We pick up stray animals, so we had 2 cats and we had a third. Now we have 6 more. I thought this cat was kind of robust looking, you know, but... So, you know, I have a relationship with my wife that's just out of this world. We have good relations with all of our children and our, you know, our extended families in terms of the relatives of my son-in-law and daughter-in-law. We've been blessed in just unimaginable ways. You know, it gets unimaginably good, which means at the beginning of the year, at the end of the year, it's better than I could have imagined it being at the beginning of the year. I expect that now. That happens every year for me. I get better. And I have, In the same circumstances, in the same situations, I have different experiences now, you know, through the grace of God. That when these steps are a part of life, the sky's the limit. And there are another reason I read you what I read tonight. There's a model that shows three levels of spirituality. The first level is the one that I've been most exposed to in AA. The second level is what Bill is talking about here. Getting down into this stuff, you know, I often hear people say, let bygones be bygones, let the past be the past. I couldn't do it. I couldn't get out of the crap by doing that. And when you do that, the third level, which I don't think I've experienced yet, is this relationship with higher power. That's impossible if that stuff is still in the way. That's my objective, and I want to thank you all. Things come up for me in this forum that, you know, I don't experience any other way. I'm grateful to have a chance to talk with all of you. Some are friends I know, and some are friends I don't know. But it's a joy to be here. So thank you very much.